With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public, free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom, and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Professor Julia Ruckledge was on our program only a few weeks ago. Professor of Psychology, Clinical Psychologist, University of Canterbury. And we were talking to her back on the 13th of March, it was, on the government funding of school lunches and whether there was a link to mental health issues with bad or no nutrition for school kids. Julia is a professor originally from Toronto, Canada, at the School of Psychology, Speech and Hearing at the University of Canterbury, director of Te Puna Toi Ora, the Mental Health and Nutrition Research Lab, theme leader in the Child Wellbeing Institute, and co-author of The Better Brain, jointly published by Penguin, Random House, and HarperCollins in 2021. And of course, there's that 2014 TEDx talk that she did, I think, in Christchurch all those years ago. Now she's back with us to discuss how to optimize nutrition to support mental health, both as a preventative and a treatment. Julia, welcome back to RCR. Nice to have you back.
Oh, it's good to be back, Paul.
The last time we talked to was around school lunches.
That's right, yeah.
And there was quite a bit of feedback regarding that. And we, you know, mental health came into that because, well, there seems to be a few mental health issues in school age population these
Absolutely.
Days. So nutrition and mental health, there's a relationship between the two, obviously.
Well, it's not obvious to a lot of people, including people who work probably in the public healthcare system and treat people with mental health disorders. But as soon as you engage in the topic and you start to think about how every time you're eating, you're constantly feeding yourself. And when you're feeding yourself, you're mostly feeding your brain. It's the hungriest organ. It's the lightest. It's 2% body weight, but it consumes between 20 to 40% of the nutrients that you eat. So when you eat, you're predominantly feeding the brain. When you start to understand that, you'll start thinking, well, then the quality of the food that I eat is going to influence potentially my brain health. And then you can keep going down that track. And then you realize that if you're not eating foods that are going to support brain health, then you can start to understand when things can start to go wrong. And that's when we start to see the development of all kinds of challenges. And if you're talking about the school age population, then you start to see behavioral problems. So you see anger, you see frustration, you see temper, you see distraction, you see mood instability. Now, all of those have got psychiatric diagnoses associated with them. And when they do get a psychiatric diagnosis associated with them, then they end up being funneled through the psychiatric system and then often medicated. And no consideration is ever given to whether or not the food environment might be contributing to those behaviors that people are seeing.
No consideration. That's quite stunning to hear, considering what you just said at the start there. You know, the energy consumed by the brain versus its body mass, that's a giveaway.
Yes, I know. Exactly. It is a giveaway. But if it's not part of your curriculum, it's not part of your education, it's not part of the medical school education, it's not part of the training for clinical psychologists, unless you go through the Canterbury program, then you start to understand that then people think that it can't be possibly relevant, because if it was relevant, then it would be talked about. But when you start to understand that a lot of medical school is about which types of drugs to use, if food is not going to be a part of that kind of discussion, is it? Looking at the nutritional environment, there isn't somebody there selling, you know, fruits and vegetables. There's no market for it. Who's going to provide that kind of education? Whereas there's a clear direct line from the pharmaceutical industry to provide education on drugs. Now, it's, you know, I'm painting a fairly simple picture there. I appreciate that it's more complicated than that. But you start to realize that nutrition gets pushed out of that curriculum because they're so overloaded with other things. And it starts to be seen as some kind of nice extra, but not seen as being core to how to treat physical and mental health problems.
Supplements are like pills, though, aren't they?
Well, they are. There's like billions of different types of supplements out there. So they are like, are you thinking, are they like drugs then in that you swap
them? Well, if you're used to prescribing drugs and things out of a bottle that look like pills, and the patient is expecting to see things that look like that, then, I mean, who's to know?
Well, that's, the challenge is that supplements, even if you think about it from a pill perspective, they're not, there's no patent associated with most supplements. There are a few where they find some kind of way around that, the patent system. But for the most part, you cannot patent a vitamin or mineral. You can't patent a herb like St. John's wort. So that means that those, they end up being thrown into this very different category from medicines. They are regulated in New Zealand as foods, and therefore they aren't given the same level of credibility as medicines because they don't go through the same level of regulation. So they're often viewed as being like the poor second cousin, I suppose, or not even that, to be honest. But it's just that they're not, there isn't the same level of rigor in research typically done with supplements, although that's the work that I've been doing for the last 15 years would be seen as an exception to that. So you don't always have that. But also, there's no incentive for the companies that make these products to do that type of research because they can't ever have a claim on their bottle to say it's got any therapeutic value because that is limited to medicines. So they can't. So there's this kind of a situation in New Zealand and also in other countries in the world where they fall into this too hard basket of we don't know how to regulate them. We understand that the risks associated with them are not as great as many pharmaceuticals, but we can't. There's no patent, so there's no system to go through. You can have lots and lots of different ingredients contained within them. The ones that I've been studying, the products I've been studying have like over 30 ingredients. The system with MedSafe to try to regulate that is based on a one molecule kind of system, like a, you know, like Prozac, which is just one molecule, as opposed to, you know, over 30. You have to provide how every single one of those interacts with each other. You start to realize why no supplement industry would ever go through or company would ever go through the process through MedSafe, because it's not designed for them. It costs a lot of money. And then at the end of the day, they have no patent protection. So I don't know if I probably just went off on a complete tangent.
No, I think we get it. Though surely in the end, is what works is what counts. I've got an example. It's nothing to do with mental health, but you know, every now and then I get fungus on my toenail. And to shift it with normal medication, well, good luck. You might knock it down a bit. I put tea tree oil on it for the last month. It's all gone. And it didn't hardly cost me anything. And it's an everyday thing. It's the only thing that's wiped it out.
Yes. And so how did you learn about the tea tree oil?
Well, I knew it was good for skin and body surfaces. So I thought, I wonder how it would work on this. Mm-hmm. So I just drip, 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 probably 10, 20 applications over a month, and it's gone. It's gone.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. And it doesn't say anything about its use as a fungal treatment, I assume,
nothing
on the bottle.
Nothing at all.
It's
an antiseptic. Antiseptic is what it has on the label.
Yeah. I mean, if you want me to be a cynic on this one or a skeptic, what a medic might say, or somebody who treats fungal disorders would say, well, it was going to resolve itself over that.
No, I don't believe that. No, not based on life experience. No, sorry.
Yes, I know, but that is what will be said. I've heard it thousands of times.
Well, that's an ignoramus talking, because you know, people's real world experience does count for something.
I completely agree.
No, I know you do.
I'm just telling you what the opposition is going to say on something like that, is that you're an anecdote, you're not data.
Yeah, so I've been dealing with this for 25, 30 years on and off, and I get one thing and it's gone, and it only took okay, so there's an example.
And so that kind of information used to get passed down for, you know, in from potentially from an oral tradition. You certainly see that within Māori, indigenous culture and knowledge gets sort of passed down that way, whereas we seem to have lost a lot of that tradition, some of that traditional knowledge of, yeah, of course, when you, you know, get a cold, then you do X, Y, Z. And we are now just, okay, when I get a cold, I go to the pharmacy and I buy a pharmaceutical. We've lost a lot of that knowledge, or we have been, our brains have been diverted by very powerful companies.
Okay, some of the terms. What are micronutrients? What are they?
So they're just simply vitamins and minerals, and it's to contrast them to macronutrients, which is what most people are familiar with. And that, well, I mean, not to say that people aren't familiar with vitamins and minerals, but when we talk about food, we talk about mostly carbs, fats, and proteins, and that's your macronutrients. Micronutrients are not talked about. If you take any package, I have, let's see, well, I mean, sorry, this is what you're going to get in my lab is a, you know, almonds.
Yeah, almonds, yeah.
Yeah, of course. So it may not be a great example, but if you look on the back of the package and it says the amount of energy and it says how much protein is in there, how much fat is in there, how much carbohydrate is in there. It doesn't say anything. It gives you a couple of micronutrients in there, which is sodium, magnesium, vitamin E. Now, I know that these almonds have got way more micronutrients contained within them than what is on the package. So the packages are telling you information about your macronutrients and your calories, but nothing much about those micronutrients. And the reason why you want to care about your vitamins and minerals and whether or not you're consuming them from your food is that they are essential for making neurotransmitters like your serotonin, your dopamine, these things we've heard a lot about in the context of mental health. They're like the factory workers. They help assemble it and make it happen. And if you don't have them there, then you just don't make serotonin very well because they're missing. So it also helps make energy molecules. It helps to regulate your DNA, keep it healthy. It helps with epigenetic effects, which is your modification of DNA through your environment. So they're important in all aspects of what's happening in your body. And yet it's not even contained adequately on your food package. So how is the public supposed to know that these vitamins and minerals are important? The reason, in my humble opinion, why they're not on your package is because it's not in the best interest of the food industry to have them on the package.
Right.
Because ultra-processed foods are devoid or very low in your micronutrients unless they've fortified it. And if they fortify it, they'll just maybe put one or two in. They certainly won't put the full array of 30 vitamins and minerals that you need for your brain to function optimally. So does that answer your question about micronutrients?
I think it does. Now, neurotransmitters, they work between neurons, do they? I'm just trying to build a picture up of how it all works. And how does that affect, okay, brain function, I can imagine, but mood regulation, that seems to, that's something different again, isn't it?
So, it's pretty straightforward. So one of the best known mood neurotransmitters is serotonin. And the reason why everyone has heard of serotonin is because of SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which is things like Prozac, sertraline, venlafaxine, paroxetine, all of
those. Who names these bloody things anyway?
I probably a marketing committee. I don't know.
It doesn't sound like constructed words.
Well, so, I mean, those are all your well-known pharmaceuticals to treat depression. And they have some effect. We could spend...
How much effect, Julia?
It's small. Relative to... This is tricky for me... some people to get their head around. We often hear about they have no effect. That is not true. That they do have an effect. But when they're talking about that they have no effect, it means that they have no effect or they have very little effect above the placebo effect. The placebo effect is very big. So that means that if you compare the effect of a placebo and the effect of the antidepressant, a lot of people on placebo will get better, and a little bit more will get better on the antidepressant.
Okay.
There's people who will argue about why that happens. They know that they're taking it, the side effects, give it away, those kinds of things. But so people can get better on these drugs, but most of the effect seems to be just that expectation, the fact that you're being looked after, you're being cared for, all of that. So they do have an effect, but it's probably mostly driven by not what we call non-specific effects. The pharmaceutical effect is probably very small. And in fact, people argue about whether it really is that or it's other things going on. But going back to your question, which is the serotonin. So serotonin is, it communicates from one neuron, from some neurons to another neuron. And it does this through serotonin being released into what's called the synaptic cleft. And then you go from the pre-neuron to the post-neuron, or the presynaptic cleft to the postsynaptic cleft. It jumps across, and then it keeps the message going.
What does the pre-stage do then?
So that's where it gets released. So it gets released from one neuron, gets released into this little, and this happens in remarkable speed, a crazy amount of speed. This is happening all the time.
Well, so, to keep up with thought, the speed of thought,
of course it does. Yes, yeah. It has to keep it. So I don't know the speed. I'm sure people do know it off the top of their head. I don't, but I know it's incredibly quick. So serotonin plays that role of just jumping, supporting the message from continuing. The SSRIs interfere with the body's ability to reuptake that serotonin back into the presynaptic cleft. That's why they're called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, so that there's more serotonin available for that message to continue with, so that you support the function of the serotonin. So there's this belief that people who have mood disorders have got a chemical imbalance or insufficient serotonin. There's no evidence whatsoever that's never been proven, never been shown, but that's the story that people are told.
But that's the story that the whole, the use of this kind of medication is based on, though, isn't it?
Correct. Yes, it is. It is.
All right. So I've known two people on Prozac, a couple of family members.
Yeah.
And it's just an observation again, what do I know? But it seemed to flatline them a bit in terms of their...
That's a common experience, is a sort of, sometimes people call it a numbing effect. So it's the chemical is definitely having an effect. And there are serotonin receptors in the gut, and so it can have gastrointestinal effects.
Oh, in the gut?
Yes, absolutely.
So that's part of the brain network.
Absolutely. So you can end up with, people will report gastrointestinal differences or disturbances can also happen if they're on serotonin. And that's a common experience for some people. And
is that why you get a gut feeling? I got 100 miles an hour here. Every time you say something, I think of something. Why we get gut feelings for things?
I think that that's certainly something that's talked about, that we do talk. There's a lot of language of our emotions revolves around
that. Feel gut it feeling, in the gut sometimes. Gutsy, you can actually feel it.
Yeah. Gutsy. There's a myriad of different expressions in English that does around the emotions of the gut. Yes. Butterflies in my stomach.
Exactly. Yeah. And likewise for the heart too. So maybe there's distributed all around the place. So communication would have to be quick between up top and down wouldn't it? Because at atomic scale, that's quite
it's a
distance.
Nerve.
It's a long way to go.
Well, it's because it's a nerve. So there's the vagus nerve.
Electric.
So it's very fast. Yeah. There are other ways that it's also there's communication that's going on between the gut and the brain, but one of them is through the vagus nerve. So yes, it is super quick. I mean, just think about how quick you experience anxiety it has to be, it's about survival. So if you got a tiger coming at you, you got to react really quickly.
So, that seems to be one of the kind of exploding mental health issues, and that is anxiety, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So
yes, it's one of them.
Why is that particularly I know it's a complicated world, and you know, fear is around every corner because it's being reported to us all the time. But
yeah,
why that one particularly, do you think?
Well, I think it's partially because part of our brain is very primitive, and that's good. It's designed to act very quickly in a survival situation. So you want your brain, you don't want it to start mulling over, is that really a tiger that I see? Or is it something else? You don't want it to think about it. You don't want your brain to overanalyze threats in our environment. So we are wired to see threats. We are wired to react more to negative things that are in our environment than positive things in our environment. You have to work really hard to reverse that and to be more positive or, you know, focused in how you interact with the world. You've got to just, that's something that you've got to put an enormous amount of effort into, because you are wired to notice negative stuff. So negative stuff, though, is something that will be more triggering of nervousness and anxiety than positive stuff. So it starts to make sense that in a world that is quite challenging for us, where there is a lot of stuff that's going around that's not very good, then you can start to understand why you end up with more and more people experiencing anxiety. If it was a tiger, you're either dead or you got out of the way and it's gone, yep. Right? When it comes to your job stresses, they don't go away. When it comes to environmental stressors, it comes to, you know, what you want to talk about political stressors, whatever it is that's going on, they don't go away. So you're just in this constant state of anxiety, of arousal, and hence we start to understand why more and more people are experiencing anxiety challenges. So,
okay, well, I don't suffer too much from anxiety, apart from if I was in front of a tiger. I would have that, or a cobra snake about to strike, or something like that. Is that because, why would that be? So I've got sufficient micronutrients powering the machine to not slip in too much into that state in an everyday way?
Yeah, I mean, it could be because some of our research shows that people who are well-nourished seem to deal with and cope with stressors a lot better than people who are poorly nourished or who have an intake of poor nutrients. So your ultra processed foods are really devoid of that. So we've got research on that to show that providing those extra nutrients can support you during really stressful times. So that certainly could be part of it. I mean, we are all wired a little bit differently. And so there are going to be potentially, and your life is good in your environment and your early upbringing is going to influence how you respond to anxiety provoking events. So I'm guessing that it might have been modeled to you to not overreact, whereas other people
probably
have different experiences. So there's a lot, it's complicated about why different people react to the same thing in different ways. But I think the reassuring thing is that in many, many cases, or in most cases, that is something that you can train yourself to do differently and respond differently.
But you have to have the mental dexterity. I don't know what the term is to be able to do that in the first place, right?
To have that kind of awareness or almost metacognitive capacity to be able to think about your thinking. There needs to be some of that. Definitely, you need to have some of that kind of brain power. But I think we could also be making sure that all of us have those skills, skills of meditation, skills of knowing how to just a really the basic thing of breathing.
Yeah.
Many people have really poor breathing habits. And so that can heighten your anxiety just through the way the nature of your breathing. You just have to go back and see how babies breathe and go, oh my God, we really do breathe differently as we get older. So I think there's some skills that can be taught to particularly to our kids around how to manage anxiety in different ways. And I know that kind of really good work goes on in schools. So we can be hopeful that those kinds of, if you went to see a psychologist, those are the kinds of things that you you might get. But I don't, I think it's not the right place to wait for the psychologist. I think these are things that we should all, this is knowledge that's out there. It's so well known. We should all have access to it without having to go see, wait to get ill and then see a psychologist to get better. That just seems to me completely the wrong way around on how to do it. You should be teaching these skills early so that you're more resilient, so that you don't end up, ultimately going down the path of a mental health problem.
There does seem to be, to someone like me, dumb guy on the street, there does seem to be an obvious correlation between mental health issues exploding is probably too much of a strong word, you'll tell me whether that is or not, especially with, children, ADHD, all of that. A correlation between the fast food, modern food environment and the numbers experiencing problems. Again, I've been on the planet long enough to remember back when I was a kid, and I don't recall in the wider group of, and that's hundreds, any standout issues with any of the kids, actually. Who knows what's going on at home, obviously.
Yeah.
But there does seem to be that correlation. That doesn't necessarily mean causation, does
Correct.
It? But it probably does, doesn't it?
We always have to be really careful about implying causation. But the way you get closer to being able to imply causation is by bringing together a whole bunch of different types of studies and information that we have out there. So when you have the correlation would be that we have an increasing consumption of ultra-processed foods and an increasing number of people who report mental health problems if they're consuming those types of foods. So that is a correlation. You could argue that people who are unwell mentally reach for the ultra-processed products. So that's the challenge with that. But then you can have, so that's one layer. Then you have the next layer, which is prospective studies following people over long periods of time and seeing whether or not what I eat today predicts my mental health down the road. And all of the studies now show that if I'm eating more ultra processed foods now, it's a risk factor. And it's a risk factor that we don't really talk about. That's the sad thing about it, is that it's such a modifiable risk factor. Although people will argue it's too expensive for people to eat well. We can't possibly talk about that. I hear that all the time.
That's not necessarily true, is it?
I know it's not. I know.
It means more effort, though, doesn't it?
It means more effort.
More discipline.
It also means more education. It means about knowing how to grow your own food. And it means about knowing when to eat certain types of foods. It's about learning how to use some foods that you may not be familiar with because they're not in McDonald's, like your lentils, your beans, your chickpeas, those types of
things. But you got to want to do it. This is the thing.
Well, yes, but I also think that some people just don't. It's not part of their world.
A lot of laziness about, Julia. A lot of laziness about.
I hate to attribute it to laziness. I think there's other factors that are probably going on as well. I think we're lucky. I think that if that's the kind of education that you have, then you are lucky and you're part of the privileged group of people who have been well supported. Other people aren't so well supported in their childhood, and so you can start to understand why they might have.
Well, I think it's the era. The era in which, I came up.
Yeah, I know. But we also have this sort of thing of like, it's your personal responsibility. And, you have a choice that you can eat different types of foods, but you choose to eat these kinds of foods. And so that you often hear about personal responsibility, but that means that the government doesn't have to do anything about it. And that means that the food industry isn't being held accountable.
Oh, I'm not in favor
really,
of that. No, I think you're pushing
But that out. Is a bit when you talk about it as being part of laziness as being a potential factor, then that is about the personal responsibility. So we flood the environment with these ultra processed products. We like 69% of foods in New Zealand supermarkets are ultra processed. So we absolutely flood the environment. We put labels on them, like food, the star rating systems that help people supposedly make better choices, but they're based on flawed system.
That's if you can read them with your eyesight.
Yeah, maybe. And then we say, oh, but it's up to you to choose other foods. So, we're going to make it so that there's that these foods are clearly a lot cheaper. We're not going to have any kind of fiscal lever that can change the cost of that. And we're not going to support, agriculture that is trying to, produce really good, healthy food. So we're going to provide subsidies for crap, all these, food, these staples that go into ultra processed foods like your soy, et cetera. And then we're not going to support the farmers who are actually trying to do things like regenerative farming. So you've got this really perverse system of telling that, and then saying it's your responsibility to make a healthier choice.
Well, you've got the medical establishment too. The way that works is it's like a sort of a hypochondriac loop in a way, isn't it? So you can be cured every time you don't feel well. And that's sort of the outsourcing the solution all the time. So you can crap till the cows come home.
But that's our culture.
And you're off to the doctor and that's a reset for the next few months and I'm okay, it's all good. And the thing just carries on.
Well, that's right. But that is outsourcing your health. And I think we all need to take back the control of our health. There are, of course, going to be situations where you need doctors. You get into a car crash, I want that to be available to me.
Yep.
But at the same time, we're thinking, okay, well, if I get a chronic illness, if I get cancer, then I know that there's a system out there, as opposed to what can I do to reduce my risk of getting some of these chronic health issues in the first place. And so taking back that control of how do I live my life? How do I change my lifestyle in order to have a positive impact in my longevity and ultimately my health span, not my lifespan, but my health span, how long I live with quality years. So, you are fighting against a lot of things, as you're saying, which is that we kind of have this expectation that the health system is there and it's going to support us.
Yeah, no matter what we do to ourselves.
But we can't afford it. If we can't afford it in the system, in the way that you describe, we can. And we keep trying or thinking that we can, and people demand it. But we've got to kind of sometimes go, well, the system is broken, and let's see if we can, create a new one. But I know that's
well, got to start
an expectation.
It'll be forced on us eventually, anyway.
Well, it is slowly.
In the field of psychology, then, when people, are trying to get help for themselves or whoever, then this should be the first line of treatment, should it? Nutrition.
I think so. Food first. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. And not supplements like what I've been studying. That's like another layer. That's proof of that.
Like mental health, well-being diets kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I've developed free courses to educate people on all of this. The information is out there, available if people want to better understand it. But I think it also needs to be more of that conversation within a health environment, within our educational environment. And it certainly was not really talked about, from what I could tell, when they had this opportunity with the school lunches to just talk about what it actually is all about.
Yeah, well, we tried to, we had that conversation. We put it out there and plenty of people listened. Who knows where it landed? I mean, thinking back to the COVID period and the incentivizing of people to get the jabs, I don't want to talk about that issue. But one of the incentives was KFC vouchers. Yeah. So that tells you everything, doesn't it?
I know. Yeah.
Because that's going in completely the wrong direction of.
Yeah, no, the biggest one of the biggest sadnesses I had about the whole COVID, and Grant Schofield and I wrote a piece really early on in all of this in The Conversation, which is an academic outlet, but it's freely available to everyone, which is that, this is before the vaccine, while we wait, there are so many things that you can do to improve your outcome, to reduce the likelihood that you're going to end up in a hospital. They already knew that people who were ending in a hospital were more likely to have co-occurring disorders. They were more likely to be obese. They were more likely to be physically inactive. There were a whole bunch of things that we knew about that population. And so we had this wonderful window of opportunity to really encourage lifestyle interventions in those early days. And who knows whether or not that might have had a difference. But there was never any, there was no discussion in all of it. There was like this one way of addressing the problem, and anything else was viewed as diverting your, you are you know, not on, you're not on board with the one thing we're trying to do. And in fact, it was about saying, well, actually, these all other things are all a very important piece of the of what we could be doing at a population level.
Wasn't
it never talked about? It wasn't talked about.
That was very patronizing, wasn't it? Because it probably made the assumptions that I was just making or expressing before, and that is that the thinking was that the average person's not capable of doing that. They won't do that. They're too in a particular mode. There's no point in promoting, you know, the things that you've just talked about because they're incapable. And actually, it's a bit of a loser mentality to.
Well, it also, I mean, it happens. I was at an ethics meeting, you know, we're trying to do a new study, and the basic message was, well, how can you possibly tell people to eat better? It's so expensive, it's unaffordable. And you're just like, you're an ethics committee. Like, you're trying to stop it from happening before we can even get started on collecting data. And so that is a sort of a common thing of, we can't possibly tell people about these other options because they can't afford it or they're not capable. And so they're not even taught, like you're taking away the choice for people, if you don't have those allow those conversations to happen. You're making an assumption that their economic status is such that they would never, ever try to change any of their lifestyle behaviors because they can't afford it. And I just don't think it's right for us to be making those decisions on other people's behalf.
Here's a radical thing. We've talked to a lot of people about reimagining a system of health in this country. Mm-hmm. Clearly, it's heading to an unsustainable, probably already there, now sort of future. I mean, it's probably a good thing to give away good food, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Just give it away.
Why not? Well, who's going to do that, though?
Well, I don't know. There must be a way of doing that.
Have,
I mean, taxpayer-owned farms.
And
take all you can get.
Exactly. I mean, there are programs overseas where, for example, I think the place to really target to start with are pregnant women, people who are pregnant.
Okay, well, are there free
exactly.
All the best food you could ever want to eat free.
Exactly.
Investment in the future of the nation.
And they do that. There are programs that have done that overseas, and it's had a really good positive impact.
Remember, they printed $17 billion over the COVID and then another $30 billion. And where is it? They could have funded all of that. $500 million on rat tests. Here I'm going on my rant. The money is there if you want to spend it.
I know. It was amazing how money suddenly appeared. Yeah, when it didn't exist before for things like prevention. So we don't spend very much on prevention. My understanding is about 2% or something of the total healthcare costs or something. But I've heard that from someone else, so I'm not sure if it's accurate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's small.
I bet we spend less on prevention than we do on everything else.
That's true. Yeah. So it is, but it is, I don't know how to start. I mean, I've sort of come to the conclusion that waiting for the government to do anything about it is not the way to go. And so I'm just being active in my own community. The people who surround me, the students at the University of Canterbury are recipients of a different way of thinking about their health from my teaching. So I see that as something that's in my control. And I've tried enough times to try to make change at a Ministry of Health level, and it just doesn't work. So.
Well, that makes me feel a bit grumpy, actually.
Yeah. So the micronutrients are shown to be effective for ADHD, and it's not even something that the public even know about.
Where should people go to find...
I wrote a book, The Better Brain. Yeah, so they could go there. She came out in 2021. Really good resource written for the lay public. So that would be a good place to start. Fortunately or unfortunately, my name is unique. So all you have to do is Google me and you will find lots of talks online. Yeah. I have developed free educational resources for the public. There's one on edX that is mental health and nutrition. It's an 8-week course. They can sign up for free if they want to, or they can pay a little bit of money to edX and get a certificate. So I don't make any money out of any of that. So they can, that's developed for the public. All of the information is in there. They choose to watch it.
Julia Ruckledge, PhD, Professor of Psychology, Clinical Psychologist, School of Psychology at University of Canterbury. They'd be happy to have you.
At University of Canterbury?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. No, they've...
Are you well supported?
Overall, very well supported.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. That was really interesting. And there's stuff, people, usable info in there.
I sure hope so. Thanks for inviting me.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day in life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.